Hello everyone, this is Ashish. Welcome back to Art Podcast. Today we are having with us Pawan Kumar Chandana, the CEO of Skyroot, founder, or will you say co-founder? How do you say it?
Co-founder, CEO, co-founder. Yeah.
All right, we have some of the rocket models that I'm sure someday or the other will come into reality. Right now you're working towards that as well. I'm very fascinated by what you are doing. It's extremely difficult science and technology in itself to understand, and I think it's even more complicated to build a business out of it and to make a sustainable model out of it. So I want to know about your timeline. I always try to understand things according to timeline. So what I know is that you graduated in mechanical engineering from IIT Kharagpur, right? In the final year, you got placed in Indian Space Research Organization.
Yeah.
And I think you were posted in VSSC. I think that's where you would have joined. But what year was it?
So it was in 2012.
All right, 2012. Yeah, yeah. And then what was the year exactly when you resigned as a resignation letter?
I think it is around June of 2020. June of 2018. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
That's like 3 months before I joined ISRO.
Oh, is it? Okay, okay.
I joined ISRO in October of 2018.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. All right. So was it like a long process or just because I know that ISRO is pretty cool about relieving people, especially VSSC, because I've been in Department of Atomic Energy as well. And I know a few of the stories where people have been waiting for a long time to get relieved and all. But was it like a 30 days notice?
Yeah, I think it's 30 days notice. And yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. But what I know about you is that you were always indulged in understanding the industry, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what I have understood about learning more and more about you, is that you not only focused on the science aspect, which obviously you are very knowledgeable in, but also how the industry works.
Yeah.
So what was the part of your journey in ISRO when you started looking towards that?
Yeah, so as you told, right? So I studied in IIT Kharagpur mechanical engineering, and that's where, you know, there was a lot of entrepreneurial vibe in the college. You know, everybody wanted to start building companies.
Oh, okay.
And I was also, you know, bit by that startup bug. So I always wanted to start a company. And also during there was a time when I felt I'll not sit for placements and go start a startup. But I was probably, you know, not I felt not knowledgeable enough or bold enough. I didn't have the guts to start straight out of college at that time. And so I just followed my passions at that point of time. And then ISRO was something which I was really looking forward to if I get the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And luckily it came to the campus,
Yeah, and it's a very on and off things.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Sometimes
so,
they
so naturally that starting a company was part of the DNA since college days.
Mm.
Right. So I wanted to start a company, you know, and in fact, I was very fascinated during my school days as well. You know, starting a company was very fascinating. I used to look up to entrepreneurs, etc., etc. So that is always there. I mean, like wanting to start a company is always there at the back of the mind. And then joined ISRO. So naturally what happens is that not only I was technically inclined, but also like I was following the industry as well. You know, what is space industry? Who manufactures what? You know, and internationally, what are the things happening? You know, so all that came naturally. You know, always wanted to observe how the industry, space industry also is emerging.
Did being in ISRO, and especially since you work with GSLV Mark III, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did that also teach you about like so many so many different factories and companies interrelated? For example, ISRO does not manufacture the components that it assembles.
Yeah.
A few of them comes from one company. There are like 3-4 different companies.
Yeah.
Did that also teach you more and more about like the whole supply chain and all that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, like not two or three, in fact, like hundreds of companies, you know, supply parts, small or big, right? So that's like a lot of companies, you know, serving ISRO. And, you know, I was also like part of the team, which also like, you know, utilizes some of the industry's products to build our parts, et cetera, et cetera. So it's always, knows the supply chain to some extent here and there. And also like at least the major supply chain is very well known. And there's very small suppliers, several hundreds of them actually, you know, so several hundreds together come to build the rocket.
Right.
Yeah, so no, at least I could say, like, I think most important ones, you know, I came to know through this journey.
Mm.
And also very fascinated, because originally I thought like such complex stuff only ISRO can build.
Mm.
And then I came to know that, you know, 80% of the stuff which ISRO launches are built in the industry itself.
Mm-hmm.
Right? At the period of time, it was developed in ISRO, then, you know, transferred to the industry, and then industry build that expertise and build that manufacturing, you know, capability, all that. So it's like several organizations build it. And so I mean, lucky enough through the journey to, you know, understand the supply chain to decent extent, I would say. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And is that the reason why you stuck around for 6 years, because you were continuously learning more and more?
No, in fact, like, I wanted to, you know, retire at ISRO, right? So, in fact, so I was there. I really loved the job for the first, all the years, in fact, until I even quit. I was so immersed in the tech. And, you know, I realized that this is, after a few years, a couple of years, I realized that life is in rockets, you know, so I have to continue.
Like the rockets have life?
Yeah, naturally. You know, I really feel rockets really have life, because so they're like probably something which have grand motion, lot of animation, lot of glamour. I think, they have their life of their own.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I think that's where, like, I always wanted to continue the life with the rockets, and really like the environment of, you know, Kerala and Trivandrum, where the entire rocket program is based. You know, really used to enjoy going out, going to the beaches, and then, you know, and then, like, going to work in the morning, you know, and then it was very fascinating time at that time. And I really wanted to continue that life there, and then probably retire one day. So that was the mindset, in fact, in the first few years.
Mm-hmm.
But as I mentioned, right, always there was like this thing in the back of the mind to start a company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I never realized that a rocket can become a company, you know, building a rocket can become a company.
Okay.
But that came later, you know, after completing probably, you know, 5 years, 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that probably it could be a business. The moment I realized that it would, I felt it's very fascinating. And also it felt like it's like nation building, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have this, you know, very strong player like ISRO, right? Which is like, which we are all proud of. And, you know, like 60, you know, almost six decades of development. And then, like, you know, there is the next step. I felt, you know, I was very strongly felt in the gut that next step is more private participation, you know,
mm-hmm.
both in design, from design, development, everything. So industry is manufacturing a lot of stuff, but from design, developing something new, you know, from the beginning, you know, do direct, you know, selling something, big service like a launch service, you know, building satellites of their own, etc., etc., was relatively non-existent at that point of time. And I felt that if you started in India, I think there's a huge opportunity. And also, I think it's very, 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 very great way to build the future of Indian space. Yeah.
Yeah. In 2018, there were no regulations to allow private players when it comes to space industry in India.
Yeah.
How did you anticipate that it will happen in future?
yeah. So it's more like a, you know, a chicken and egg problem, right?
Oh, okay.
So that means, like, unless there are companies there, the policy may not come as fast as we want.
Oh, okay.
And unless there's policy, I think you cannot do what exactly you want to do, like, you know, getting a license for a rocket launch or, you know, license to launch your satellites, etc., etc. So I realized that it is a chicken and egg problem. In fact, I felt it more like an opportunity, because I knew that it's going to come. Probably it's going to take 5 years, 10 years, I don't know, but it's definitely going to come. But when it comes, I think, you know, because we'll be one of the early players, so it was an opportunity, right? So that's what I felt. It was good. In fact, I felt 2018, after starting, I realized 2018 is late, you know. Probably could have started early, you know, probably by this time we could have been like one of the, you know, key players in the launch business already, right? If you start early. So many people think 2018 is early, but I would say it's actually quite late. Could have started early, but I didn't get that, probably that conviction to start before 2018. Yeah.
So when you started this, for example, Dr. Vikram Sarabhai started with an idea that space for the service of the nation.
Yeah.
That's somewhere along the line how the quote of the ISRO goes. And I think he had the ambition of launching satellites. What would you say? Did Vikram Sarabhai had an idea that we are going to have interplanetary mission, or he started with an idea that we are going to help this nation build with mostly like satellites?
Yeah, so I'm very sure that he knew that the first step is, you know, at that time in India, right? 1960s in India, right?
Yeah.
He felt that you know, the people of India, you know, need to use as much science and technology as possible to go to the next phase, mm-hmm. right? So he strongly felt that, and then like, you know, and space is one technology which can actually you know, transform lives. You mm-hmm. know, for example, TV comes from the direct to home,
right.
Television comes from space, mm-hmm. and there were like the early television connection you know, sub programs which were done by Dr. Sarabhai himself, you know, some time, mm-hmm. right? And so that's what he felt, that you know, in fact, in one of his famous statements, he said that we don't have fancy to compete you know, with other nations mm-hmm. on interplanetary exploration or things mm-hmm. like that, but we don't want to be second to anybody,
right.
in, you know, transforming lives using space technology. I think that was a step. So satellites was can, you know, using satellite services, etc., can transform lives. You know, you can be used by agriculture, fishermen. Even today, you know, a lot of fishermen uses this advisory coming mm-hmm. from the government, you know, mm-hmm. to tell them exactly where the fish goes. And in fact, they spend, you know, you save you know, billions of dollars, you mm-hmm. know, in fact, last few years, billions of dollars in fuel,
mm-hmm.
because you did not keep on moving to understand where the fish is, and fishermen did not, you know, wait several days, they did not go and come back without a fish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So now I think it's all I think a good amount of fishermen, they know exactly where the fish is through these advisory services,
right.
Which use satellite data and then go. I think common man in India, I think a lot affected by space technology.
You can
technology.
Study the crop field and all.
Pardon?
Crop field and all.
Yes, yes, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And even urban planning, you know, infrastructure
mm-hmm.
planning,
mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of space is used in that, and television, of course.
And you can use it to spy on other countries, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's always like, always the defense is attached to it, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know that you have watched the series Rocket Boys because you talked about it.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
I think it was shown in that manner that Vikram Sarabhai, along with Dr. Homi Bhabha, actually pitched it like that to Nehru,
yeah.
that it will help you in the defense index sector as well.
As well, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, even the way the NASA started,
yeah.
they just got one run, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he was like straight up creating missiles in Germany.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is quite obvious. But the way that you can see even the logo of ISRO,
yeah.
It's like a rocket and satellite solar panels on the side, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's great that we are moving towards what do you call other celestial bodies landing on that. They obviously did that with the Mars orbital mission and now the Chandrayaan 3. Can you share some of the thoughts on Chandrayaan 3?
Oh, I mean, see, in fact, I watched it live. I literally had tears in my eyes watching it land,
mm-hmm.
because I knew how significant event this is. And as a technologist myself, I knew how difficult this is. You know? So I think it's a phenomenal achievement by India.
Is.
Very proud of being Indian, actually, you know, being the first country to actually launch on the South Pole, you know, near to the South Pole. And also, like, you know, among the four elite countries in the world, you know, to land soft land on the moon, not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel, you know, second attempt is not easy. You know, I think most people think, yeah, and I expect ISRO to do it in the first attempt.
Right.
But I think second attempt itself is, you know, quite difficult. And I think we have done it really well, and I think spot on with high precision. And also, even internationally, if you see, there were several attempts by US and you know,
mm-hmm.
USSR, that time USSR,
yeah.
to land on the moon. It was so you know, difficult to actually soft land on the moon. It required so many attempts and so much of
even Russia failed a few days ago.
yeah. Unfortunately,
yeah.
I mean,
it's
a bit of a sad event, I would say.
No,
yeah.
What I'm saying is that even they were successful once,
yeah,
even
yeah.
after that, it is difficult.
Yes, yes, yes.
So,
in fact, see, this was Lunar 25,
mm-hmm.
so Lunar 24 was successful, you know, I think they were landed in, but that was, I think, some 1976 or something, you know,
mm-hmm.
several years, 47 years ago,
mm-hmm.
they have launched,
mm-hmm.
succeeded, but the point is that 47 years is too long.
Yeah.
Too long.
It's a different organization.
Yeah, completely different organization now, you know.
Yeah.
Probably there were no common people, etc. Mm-hmm. But doesn't matter. I think they have gone till orbit and, you know, probably some glitch here and there, which is very unpredictable. Any space mission is unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
And very glad that India made it. And, like, I think we watched it with the entire team and we were elated, completely elated looking at the kind of launch, I mean, the landing and everything, I think. Phenomenal precision. It was just like 19 minutes of event. And, you know, it was like history scripted in those 19 minutes. And I think it really shows, puts India in the spotlight. You know, I got, I think, several messages from people across the world, you know, looking at it, you know. And I think the whole image of India changes with such
of
event.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now people pay attention towards you. And also, I remember so many people making fun of ISRO back in 2019.
Yeah.
At that time, I was in ISRO working. You must have recently left.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were some taunts and few sentences given. What do you think caused the ultimate failure in the landing of Chandrayaan 2? Because so far there's no official statement from us for the right reasons, I believe. But what do you think?
Yeah, so I think there was some recent presentation by chairman of ISRO where, like, you know, he described how it was, you know, what went wrong, right? So from it, what happened is that there were like multiple phases of Chandrayaan 2. Right? First is there's something called rough braking. You know, you switch on the engines and then, you know, you brake it roughly from orbit. You know, you slowly slow down from that 1 kilometer, 1.6 kilometer per second. You slow down, and then there is a phase called camera coasting, right? So that means, like, the camera is pointed towards the ground and the spacecraft should not, you know, change its attitude. That means it should not change its direction. And it has to, you know, look at the moon surface during that, you know, period of time. So during that, it also has to burn its engine and slow down, right? So what happens is that the thrust was slightly more than what it's supposed to have, but it was still in the bound of the, you know, the engine, it seems, upper bound of the engine, but still it was in the uppermost bound. It's called upper bound, lower bound, as you know, right? So it went in the upper bound side of the engine. And because of that, what happened is the errors added up, you know, of these seconds where it did this camera coasting, and it the errors added up. And the moment this phase completed, I think the errors were like very large. And then it had to go to the, you know, launch site, wherever landing site. And when it has to go to the landing site, because the errors are more, so it has to rotate more to actually go to the landing site. But then there were the software limited it, saying that because they never expected that so much errors would come up, so they limited the rate to something like 10 degrees per second. That means the spacecraft should not rotate beyond 10 degrees per second. But then to actually reach its landing site, it has to rotate more, right? So what happened is it got confused completely. And then it was like, you know, it has to go to the landing site, then it cannot rotate beyond a particular limit, right? So because of this software glitch, you know, of these limits put on the spacecraft, and also that there was no control during this phase, you know, the errors added up, which was also avoidable. So because of these unexpected, unavoidable mistakes, you know, it couldn't land. And probably, you know, that's what happens in most space missions. If you see, like, what is the reason for failure? Very, very small, minute things. You know, most things, even which are successful, also just succeed by whisker. And then most things which fail is like very little reasons, you know, very, very minute reasons. And I think that is a great learning. And and then so that also in 2019, right, there's a lot of criticism after it crashed, like you said, right? So, and then that criticism is unwarranted, because space missions are like that. And but still, you know, ISRO had that resilience to you know, take it in. And then, you know, years of development, years of extreme testing, they brought in all perfect. I think Chandrayaan 3, the kind of improvements made in from Chandrayaan 2 to Chandrayaan 3, and the kind of testing done, I think I was sure shot. In fact, I tweeted before the landing that it's going to land.
Okay.
You know, so I was so confident that it's definitely, I'm sure, because of the confidence I have with ISRO, the spirit of ISRO, and also the kind of technical changes they have done. I think I was sure that it was going to land.
Okay.
But still, it was very nervous, because everything is unpredictable in space. And finally, it nailed landing perfectly and made all of us proud.
Right. Yeah. So was it like a lack of fail-proof in the software in the Chandrayaan 2? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So there were some limits in the software, you know, which need not have been there probably, you know, and because it was not expected that these limits will be, you know, that spacecraft will touch these limits. But unfortunately, it touched those limits because of other reasons, you know. So because of that, you know, but it's still, you know, if everything was nominal in that flight, it would have landed.
What I heard, the rumors is that ISRO has actually built a new facility for the landing testing, which was not there in Chandrayaan 2.
No, naturally, I mean, like, once you you know, want to build a new spacecraft and learn from what already happened, naturally you have more testing. In fact, like, Chairman ISRO has said that, you know, previously there were 3 sigma testing, three times of all the deviations of the standard deviation, right? Now it has become 6 sigma testing. I mean, I would say, like, super extreme, you know, 6 sigma is like very extreme testing. Probably will not be required for, you know, most missions, but they did that level of testing, which is double of the dispersions which happened in Chandrayaan too. Mm-hmm. So that is, I think, that would require. And also, they probably, I'm sure, they might have created new test beds to simulate all the scenarios. In fact, I was also told that even the ground software, simulation tests were extremely done. Mm-hmm. Literally, all the scenarios were tested to the extreme deviations and then tested. And naturally, after all this testing, you have to stick the landing. And and it went like picture perfect.
All right. So initially, I started talking about what ISRO's ambition was. It was mainly because I wanted to know what your ambitions were when you decided to go with Skyroot. I have heard you talking about space tourism as well.
Yeah.
Or there are different ways you can go. For example, Blue Origin is mostly towards space tourism, and SpaceX would be more towards Mars and settlement over there. But what were your ideas?
Yeah, so the idea was to, at that time, we had this phrase saying democratizing space, right? And so now, in fact, we found a better line for it. We call it opening space for all, right? So that's the core agenda for...
Is there a motto line for Skyroot as well?
Yes, it's the motto for Skyroot. And it's our core purpose is to open space for all, right? So opening space for all means two things. One is opening space services, for as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. Today, for example, GPS is everybody uses. Mm-hmm. Television directly from satellite, many people use it. And, and the only 90% of the Earth's surface is today connected by satellite, because of course 70% is ocean, but by area, 90% of the Earth is the only way is through satellite. The connectivity is through satellite. And all the ships are connected via satellite, and lot of things, even ATMs are, most of the ATMs are connected by satellites. So I think the satellites already revolutionized life and common man, even when there is fish on your plate, that the fisherman was actually, got an advisory from the satellite to find where the right shoals of fish were. And even when you draw your cash from the ATM, most of the ATMs are, many of the ATMs are connected by satellite. And when you use a GPS for navigation, it comes from satellite. Mm-hmm. And several other things, even in remotest villages, all the connectivity, both internet, even mobile connectivity, many of it is from space. And all, like you mentioned, even the border surveillance. Today, I think it's very difficult to win a war without space.
Of course.
It is, you actually, even most of the recent operations, even the surgical operation, et cetera, so.
About the Kargil war, India went out and asked for the GPS from America for, because Pakistani army was at the higher altitude.
Yeah.
I think that that's exactly when India started with the NAVIC program, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's several things. I think one is navigation. So, IRNS's, our own navigation, will give a very good self-reliance, I would say. Yeah. So space is very important even for, strategic purposes per se. Mm-hmm. And that also space gives, in addition to all this, so it protects us as a nation. So that is also what space brings all of us. So, space is already... to a lot of people, but still, I believe it's less than probably 1% of what actually space can give for humanity. Mm-hmm. So that means space is already what people use, but still it's totally not for all. It's not, space is still not open for all, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what we wanted to do. We want to make it open as much as possible. So what is opening for all of us? More and more people using satellite services. For example, every farmer, probably even you can detect pests on your farms using satellite. Mm-hmm. You can know when to irrigate your plants using satellite. There's a temperature difference which comes using infrared satellite. You can find out that these leaves are slightly dry. You can when to irrigate. You save water. You increase food production. Mm-hmm. Right. So that today is very expensive.
Just a curious question.
If
we are going to use infrared, why to do it from a satellite rather have a helicopter? What would be the difference?
So, the point is that the cost of using a satellite, per kilometer square, is very, very cheap compared to drones or, helicopters. Because, see, you can actually literally survey, because it's called a synoptic view, right? Mm-hmm. So the view is so high that you can actually have if you have very high resolution satellite, you can cover a lot of surface of the earth in just one day, right? So you cannot, you need not help just one farmer or one farm. You can help several thousands of hectares, across the earth every day. Right. I think that can be done by satellites. So opening of opening space for all, like I meant, is like more people using space services, number one. More people accessing space. That means like not only people using services, people also, you know, today we think space is very far off. You know, actually, if you see, space is just 80 kilometers, you know, 80, 100 kilometers. Mm-hmm. In fact, our launch, which did last year, it just took 2 minutes to reach space. You know, and it took like, you know, it takes in Hyderabad peak traffic, probably, you know, it takes 40 minutes to cover 5 kilometers. And it hardly takes like 2 minutes to reach 80 kilometers. And it takes like 10 minutes to orbit. To reach orbit, you know, it's so near. Just that, you know, we are unable to access it because today's tech is still you know, evolving. And just like aircrafts, once upon a time, you know, it was very difficult to even navigate on Earth, to go from one place, not navigate, I mean, go from one place to other place on Earth, you know, going between continents was very difficult. Now it's like completely open for everybody. And but space, even though it's very close, still not open for all. Open for all, you can go to space probably for, you know, holiday, you can go to space.
What will you do up there? It's super complicated to stay in space, right? Gravity.
You know, I mean, see, if you see like more than 20 years, right? So people are continuously staying in space, in the International Space Station. But of course, you know,
they are doing like zero gravity research and all.
Research and all, you know, but it is definitely fun for a holiday. I don't think you will not even know, you know, it'll be such a smooth ride up there. You know, you float in space for some time, and if you have all the facilities, it'll be, you know, very good ride up, staying in space and coming down. I think that'll be a solved problem in the next, you know, 10, 20 years. You know,
okay.
I think probably regular people going to space and coming back.
I was thinking about utility. Can it actually make our travel quicker? For example, intercontinental ballistic missile, can we go out and and obviously when you reach the orbit, you're traveling much faster. I think that would be the benefit for the what you were saying about the satellite as well. You don't need to fight the resistance of the atmosphere. So is there something like we leave the atmosphere, pass the Kármán line, and then orbit, and then it would be a quicker flight, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, every point on point on Earth under an hour is possible with rocket flight. You know, so that is also going to happen. You know, once rockets become as regular as aircrafts, you know, as reliable as aircrafts, because it's like the engineering is very tough. You know, one is going to orbit, probably is more or less, you know, probably I would say like it's more or less figured out, but coming back from orbit is like still a, you know, open problem.
Right.
So it's like that took continuously, like aircrafts, you know, regularly working for hundreds of flights, thousands of flights, is still, you know, an open problem to solve. And so that will transform even travel, like you said, right? But you know, it'll need a spaceport, and you know, there'll be a lot of infrastructure that time. Moving from one point on Earth to other point, very far off places, can be covered in minutes, literally. So that is, so there is another transformation. So like you said, you know, traveling on Earth, continent to continent, will become super fast, you know, and going on a holiday for space will become quite easy, and then working in space, you know, so I think space will become a good hotbed for a lot of manufacturing in the future. You know, so there are like even today is a lot of good things identified, like, you know, optical fibers and some pharmaceuticals which are very good to manufacture in space, because in zero gravity environments continuously a lot of research happens even at ISS on this. And so even manufacturing, a lot of manufacturing happens in space, and a lot of heavy manufacturing can actually slowly shift to space. And and then like once space becomes you know, more and more accessible, I think the world changes, transforms like anything, you know. I think both the services, going to space, you know, working in space, you know, living in space, all this become a reality.
The most interesting fact is when you look at the Apollo missions, you see a giant Saturn V, right? And that takes for you to go from Earth to Moon. And when you see what leaves from Moon, it's just a small capsule, right? Then they come back. So it's mostly like the big gravity forces and also the atmosphere that you fight with. And, you know, launch vehicle is a big like mass versus what you lift and how much you need to lift that. And it's also said like if Earth was a little bit larger, it would be like impossible
to go to orbit.
So there was a concept of space elevator, which I think never came into fruition.
But
I know that there's an ISS so you can build a station.
Yeah.
Can you build something which is in orbit, which can be used as a launch pad to go further?
So there is concept like space elevator where if you drop something from space,
mm-hmm.
right? Let's say something like a elevator where you can because it has a velocity already, and then because of gravity it is aligned to Earth, etc. Mm-hmm. You hold it and then go on top of it, just like an ant walking mm-hmm. over a long rope,
mm-hmm.
right? If something of that sort can be made, I think technically on paper it will make space flight like very, very easy. Even today, even on Mars and moons, there are like concepts which are possible, mm-hmm. Where like using space elevators, transport within Mars or moon, much, much easier than Earth, definitely,
mm-hmm.
But here, because of the Earth's huge gravity and then, carrying that weight through that long, technically, there's no material which can, build a space elevator, So technically it's becomes like very, very challenging to make, but
right.
on paper it's possible. And today I think it's probably one of the first uses might come in other places like, Mars or moons, where it is easier to, build a system to test and then, prototype to prove it. And then, I think that will become probably a very common low cost way of, movement to up and down from space.
And that is what Elon Musk's original plan was, to use moon as a launch pad, right? To use that to go to Mars. And a lot of people question, why are we going to moon? One obvious explanation that a lot of people now understand is mineral mining. Do you think there are significant minerals that we can use over there?
Yeah, I mean, see, moon has a lot of minerals for sure. Mm-hmm. And so one of the thing which most people, talk about is having that helium-3, right? So helium-3 can be used for generating energy, for using nuclear fusion, right? Which is also evolving right now. So we already have nuclear fission based energy through nuclear energy, but nuclear fusion is something which, without producing any harmful radioactive waste, you can produce energy. So that's what humankind needs. But still it's in research phase right now. Very stably producing energy from nuclear fusion is yet to achieve in significant amounts, and once that is achieved, I think helium-3 could play a very important role in creating huge amount of energy, mm-hmm. and that is not available on Earth. It is available on Moon, and in fact that comes from the solar radiation. The sun is having a lot of helium,
right?
And when that passes through the dust of Moon, it gets captured, and then there is helium-3. But Earth's magnetosphere will make it escape, and you can never get helium-3 on Earth, but you have a lot of helium-3 on Moon. But still, I mean, lot in sense, it's not very huge. It needs extensive mining, huge amount of tons and tons of mining to get probably few grams or kilograms of helium-3. But still, I mean, that is good amount of energy produced, and it's very costly material. That is one example of where Moon resources can be used to generate large amount of energy on Earth.
I need to elaborate a little bit more on that. I did not know about this. So you're saying that helium comes from sun, travels to moon? I thought that only electromagnetic waves reach.
I think see, there's something called solar. In fact, this Aditya, a lot of things we don't know about sun till now. But there are some things which do come from sun and particles, not only electromagnetic radiations, does even these particles also do come. And there's also propulsion, which happens because of the solar radiation.
Solar wind, right?
Yeah, solar wind. And the same wind, also has this helium particles, which, goes into the, the surface of the moon, dust of the moon gets captured there. And then we can get it. So it's very, very, very,
right.
probably, even when I came to know, it's very exciting thing that, comes from the sun.
All right. Can we get to explaining more about your rockets? Can I bring one model?
We'll
start with Vikram 1. And explain what stages you have over here.
Vikram 1 has three major stages, right? So stage 1, 2, 3, which have carbon, all built with carbon fiber. You know, structures are built with carbon fiber, and
even the solid lower fuel. Stages.
Pardon?
Even the lower stages.
Lower stages.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So entire vehicle is carbon fiber. The entire structure is carbon fiber. One of the first few in the world to have all carbon fiber structure in a rocket. And so this has solid fuel. The first three stages of solid fuel generates huge amount of thrust at a low cost. And, we can, for example, just to give an idea, the first stage generates a peak thrust of 120 tons. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's how much, can lift like 50 elephants using that kind of this thing. And the rocket is like something like, more than seven storied building tall.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a kick stage, which we call OAM, Orbit Adjustment Module. So which also gives a kick to the final kick to the satellites to reach orbit. And then also it can adjust the orbit, it's called Orbit Adjustment Module.
Yeah.
You can change the orbit if you want, to slightly, and if you want one satellite to go to one orbit and you want another satellite going in the same mission in a different altitude, you can always go to a different altitude, etc. So it has like three solid fuel stages and one liquid fuel stage, which is called the orbit adjustment
very
module.
Similar to SSLV, I think.
Yes, so SSLV is much bigger, I would say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it uses a good amount of metals as well.
Mm-hmm.
and they use the upper stages use a different type of composite.
Mm-hmm.
but it's quite a massive compared to Vikram 1.
Vikram
1 is slightly much smaller. Mm-hmm. Compared to SSLV.
Does these thrusters also are controlled? Is this the roll controlled one that you had a launch like 9 months ago or so?
So it has a roll control thrusters as well.
Mm-hmm.
So which is also liquid, by the way. So we have the reaction control, which is also liquid fuel. So as the rocket goes up, there'll be like, roll control, forces which generate the roll on the rocket.
Right.
When the rocket rolls, you need to bring it back for better control of the entire, ascent.
Mm-hmm.
And so these roll thrusters just give pulses. They give pulses to bring back the, rocket in a proper, bring back to its original, attitude. Yeah.
Yeah. 9 months ago, you had one launch from Sriharikota, right?
Correct.
Was this the same one?
Yeah. So that was called Vikram S. So that was a test rocket. For example, Vikram 1 is an orbital rocket. That means it launches satellites to orbit.
Mm-hmm.
And what we launched last year is a test rocket which goes to space but not orbit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it needs less energy, and it's a much smaller rocket. It's a two-storied building tall rocket, while this is a seven-storied building, just to give an idea about the size.
Mm-hmm.
And so that went up to 90 kilometers.
Yeah.
Just crossed that 80 kilometer. Mm-hmm. Altitude, and then went to space, and then reached 90 kilometers and then fell back into the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it goes to space and then tests all the technologies which
it's
we wanted
like a
to
parabola.
Test. Yeah. And then it's more like testing most of the tech, 80% of the tech, propulsion, structures, materials, so many things are proven here. A lot of electronics got proven there, right? So a lot of testing of the Vikram 1 technologies were done in Vikram S.
Right.
And it was more like a demonstrator flight, which was successful in the first attempt.
Mm-hmm.
And then using a lot of learnings from there, even thermal, aerodynamics, everything, we were able to prove most of it things there.
Mm-hmm.
And all those learnings, we are bringing it to Vikram 1, which we are going to launch in few months. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I saw that launch and pardon me because I used the wrong term. That was roll stabilized, right?
Yeah.
It rolled to stabilize.
Itself, correct.
Right?
Yes.
And I think that did not have thrust vector control.
Right. So that's one difference between this and that is that that is a rolled control vehicle. What happens is that whenever there is an engine, for example, that has a solid fuel engine or a solid fuel motor.
Mm-hmm.
So it has some, however best you manufacture it, you'll have a slight tilt in the nozzle.
Mm-hmm.
So there'll be like, 0.1 degree, 0.2 degree, slight deviation.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have that deviation, the rocket just steers away.
Mm-hmm.
Either you should have thrust vector control to just bring it back and then control it, or you should have a roll, which will balance it out. So there'll be one angle, and then the next moment it is at a different angle, so it all balances out. So what we wanted is that it's a very simple vehicle which can test most of the whole purpose is to test technologies and then bring it very quickly. In fact, from design to launch it was just 2 years, which was a record time, and then we built a very simple vehicle. We used roll stabilization so that we didn't want to complicate things. And then it went, and it has a slight angle on the fins. that generates the roll a little bit, and also it has few thrusters which will give a roll the moment it crosses the launch pad. It gives a thrust, and then it is sustained by the angle on the fins. You know, it was super. In fact, I felt it was easier, but it is actually turned out to be super complicated to have a roll stabilized vehicle, to have those high precision angle on the wings, the fins. You know, and also like, you know, having those thrusters work straight the moment after launching the launch pad. So we spent a lot of time to getting that right.
But how did you design the solid stages? Did you design it from scratch?
So everything we build are completely designed from scratch. You know, in fact, you know, we have probably done simulations. So every solid fuel has a grain, you know, the inside, the shape of the
Did you use HTPB?
Yeah, it's HTPB based. And then it has a grain of different shapes. That's right. That gives you the thrust time curve.
Oh, the hollow inside.
Right? Yeah, the hollow inside. One is of, some have fins, some have a mixture of fins and cylinders. Some have, it's like, you know, that is actually the crux of the design, where, you know, how you design that shape.
How fast it burns.
How fast it burns, when it burns, you know. So you don't want thrust to be very high during a zone called max Q. Max Q is like, you know, high dynamic pressure. The maximum stress on the rocket comes at that point during the journey of the rocket. So we want, you know, the thrust to come down slightly before it goes there, so that then the velocity is less there, you know. So then you have less stress. So it's like it's like a multidisciplinary problem to design the kind of thrust you give, you know. So that's the advantage of a you know, designing a proper grain in solids. You get this whenever you want, you can throttle it, you know, and you know, by design you can throttle it, and then you see that the stress on the rocket is low, and then you can bring it back so that you know because the more the thrust, you get more payload to orbit, you know, because you're fighting gravity, you know, and something called gravity loss. So the more you the less time you burn, that's why high thrust is good, but high thrust is not very good because it gives huge velocity during high stress zone. And so all that, you know, so there's a lot of factors designed in it. And then we had to like undergo like maybe thousands of simulations to get the right kind of grain, you know,
so
for the rocket.
You did the simulations in computer?
Yeah. So we developed everything from scratch, you know, whether it is, you know, the solid propulsion simulation or like even liquid propulsion. There's a lot of liquid propulsion in Vikram series. This is Vikram 1, which has liquid, two types of liquid engines, one for the roll control and one for the final orbital insertion. And then we have also cryo, you know, cryogenic is like even more complex. Both the fluids are cryo, both the fuel and oxidizer are cryo, and we have a simulation tool for that. And then we have simulation tool for trajectory, we have simulation tool for the control, even everything, you know. Literally we built everything from scratch.
So fast took, though.
You did
so much so quickly.
So in fact I mean, it took several months to build the first version, and several months to fine tune it, and it requires launch also to fine tune it. In fact, like, you know, the launch also gave us like a lot of new information. We keep fine tuning it from there. I think it's a never ending process. And and
do you think that in position like that, when you have to move very fast, is important to have a smaller team? Like giant organization like ISRO will also move slower, because you have to take care of so many different teams and all. But when you are having like a single team,
so definitely smaller teams will be more nimble and faster. And also, but the crux is that you will not fully ever remain as a smaller team. So now, you know, we are you know, going to reach, you know, probably, you know, in few months reaching 300 plus people, right? You know, so it's like not a small team anymore,
right?
and then, like, you know, ISRO has thousands of people. Not only ISRO, so many organizations have thousands of people. So the crux is actually in managing that agility as you grow. Like, for example, even today, or the way SpaceX is functioning, I think maybe 15,000 employees, still super fast. And also, like, I mean, ISRO is also like, I think, good inspiration, because they do a wide range of missions very quickly. I mean, quite a nimble team, and I think they have a lot of missions coming up in the future as well. So I think I think it's a problem to be solved on how to manage the inertia as the organization grows.
And ISRO especially does not work as a government organization at all. Like, it's a very unique, it's not only just a government organization, it's a central government organization. But yet it is so agile. I think there's an air in ISRO that is there. Like, there's a different kind of air that will just make you, because even in IITP, you have been in IITP,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
And there are scientists who retired like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And they talk that they're young as 40 or so. You wouldn't say that they have won such big awards and now they are like consultants. And yet they have that agility.
Yeah, and
that motivation.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So when it comes to this organization, how did you manage to gather the engineers? Now, I understand that you would understand launch vehicles well, but obviously you don't have a specialization in a particular domain. Now, if you have to make solid boosters, which is a very complicated and also very dangerous task.
How do you
take care of that? And how do you proceed towards hiring people? Did they have prior experiences and did you handpick those people?
Yeah, so maybe like you can say like around 10 to 15% people have prior experience, worked in the systems before. So many veterans work with us, you know, full time. Each of them have like maybe 40 years experience in the field, right? So all that is there, but still, you know, that's not at all enough, you know, because the you know, the real 90% of the people also have to be work together at the same pace and same you know, knowledge to make it happen. So what we do is that we recruit like really smart people as much as possible. You know, so in fact, like maybe the average ratio would be like with 1,000 is to 1, you know, so 1 from 1,000 people, you know. So that is what we try to get, some really smart people out there, and they learn very fast.
Did you recruit freshers as well?
Yeah, we do. We do recruit freshers as well. Yeah. And train them. In fact, I think the future will be like training more and more freshers, where, you know, because you don't have like a lot of experienced people per se, and you create experience. That's the only way you can do it. And probably we have trained like hundreds of freshers as of now, you know, over the last 5 years. So that's what is, you know, building, you know, it's actually building in a way, you know, even though it's in small amounts now. So these hundreds will become thousands in the entire private sector tomorrow. Right. So it's hardly like, you know, 2 years since the policy has come, and already probably several thousands are working across all together. If you add up all people working in the, you know, startups in building space vehicles, or like I'm talking about building space systems, overall space startups, it's in thousands now already. Right. And that's going to grow. I mean, down the line, it will cross several tens of thousands. And just imagine such manpower being there in India. I think it's very much required for us in the future. Yeah.
Right. And especially when I was preparing to get into ISRO, there's like only one option. If you want to work in a space organization, you have to get into ISRO.
Yeah.
And as you know, I appeared in my last ISRO attempt in 2018. That was like right when you guys were starting up, right? But now the youth has so many opportunity, and there are so many people who approach me about like, I want to get into space science and engineering. And especially, you know, that 2020 in January, there was an ICRB examination, and then the COVID happened, and then it is like a 2021, and now we are seeing another recruitment.
Yeah.
And in between that, there are so many people who graduated.
Yeah.
And they all want to get into space science and engineering. I think organizations like yours, companies like yours, are giving those people an outlet to what they want to work towards, right? What is your recruitment process? How do you hire people?
Yeah, so we have we are very active on LinkedIn. So we you know, put up these profiles on LinkedIn, and you know, probably on average, always probably 8 to 10 recruitment open positions are always there, and sometimes even more. And then like people apply through LinkedIn, and then we also promote the positions through Twitter, probably, you know, as a snapshot of what are the open positions, and then we reach out. We have you know, a team which reaches out to people who have you know, some sort of experience which they believe could fit us, and so that is also is, you know, one way of you know, reaching out to people. And then and we also like promote to our you know, employees as well, you know, so they also talk to their networks, you know, and whenever there's an open position, they'll, you know, try to find who's the right fit among their circles. So like that, there are various channels in which we do, but primarily through LinkedIn is what you know, we do, because I think most of the people, most of the job seekers are out there. At least they have a profile there, and then it can reach to them. And but it's one of the various channels, but majorly through LinkedIn. Yeah.
Right. So you look at the profile, maybe the resume, and then you directly call for an interview?
Yeah. So that's what we do.
But you sit for the interview yourself? Like you handpick them, or you have a recruitment interview team and you don't sit for that panel?
Yeah. So what happens is that firstly, you know, the HR team, you know, talks to them, understands if there is interest, understands if there is a relevant experience, understands if they are like really passionate to join and all that. And then the team, one of our team members will interview them to check how technically good they are, you know. And finally, you know, me or Bharat, you know, one of us will interview, take the
You
final.
Were like roommates and left together.
So we both, you know, started together. We were like flatmates at Trivandrum and, you know, during the time of VSSC. So very close friends, we started together. And then, so now what happens is that we take, either one of us takes the final round of interview. You know, we see that, you know, everything is matching what we need. Except the passion is, you know, there,
right.
You know, and all that, you know, we see that all the boxes are ticked, whatever we want, a Skyroot person should be. And then we, you know, give them an offer, and then, you know, they become part of our journey.
That's a great way of hiring, because what we, unfortunately, what we see in the process of ISRO, and it's not even a problem with ISRO, it's just the mammoth size of it, is that there's a written test.
Yeah.
Which a lot of time is luck. You have given IIT JEE examination, so you know how it works, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm so happy that there are organizations like Skyroot where you're looking for passion, right? Even in my ISRO interview, they never asked about passion. It's only like technical questions. And that part goes out. And would you say that it is more important for you to be passionate and motivated than for you to be technically competent?
Yeah, so I think a good mix of both. But what we, you know, give less importance to is like having huge amount of experience or relevant experience. Mm-hmm. Something may not be, you know, required, you know, because people can build the skill sets.
Right.
So if the person is passionate enough and the fundamentals, when it comes to technical part, we don't compromise on fundamentals. Mm. You know, so fundamentals should be very good.
Okay.
And the passion should be good.
Right.
Passion and attitude should be good. If these two are ticked, I think experience becomes less relevant to us.
Okay.
Yeah.
How would you test a fundamental? I want to just know.
So I mean, the way is that, you know, we ask them a problem statement in the interview itself, right? Mm. Like, you know, video face-to-face interview. Mm-hmm. But it's easier to solve a problem on the paper once you get the problem statement. Mm-hmm. You know, probably you can read, learn, and then, you know, build it. We do that also. So we give them problem statements, ask them to solve some really tough problems, you know. They come up with solutions. We see how they solve. You know, some of them may not be able to solve the problem, but it doesn't matter. You know, we see how they solve, how they approach the problem. And then, you know, if we like the approach, how they're thinking, I think that's good enough. Mm-hmm. And then in really face-to-face interviews, at least what I do is that I ask them something very fundamental. Very, very fundamental.
Give me an example. That's what I want to know. Like, is it computational fluid dynamics fundamental?
Not at all. In fact, I'll tell you, I mean, very surprisingly, there are people with like 10, 15 years of experience. Mm. You know, they work in like, I ask them like what kind of materials do you work with, for example, you know. So they say, okay, aluminium alloy, you know, so and so alloy, you know, 6 series, 7 series, you know, so some fancy alloy. You know, I ask them, what is the density of the alloy?
Mm.
Many people do not tell it right.
Even though they have worked with it. Okay.
So because they never felt that it was needed. Probably, you know, it was not needed for the job to actually know the density of that material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably they are in integration or they are in something else. Probably not related to, you know, actually testing the material. But it's very fundamental to have the curiosity to know what the material strengths are, what the material's densities are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that is missed, I think it's a no-go for us. I mean, at least how much experience they have. Because we see how much curious that person is.
Right.
You know, for example, a really curious guy, he would learn a lot of things around what they work, right? So they might know how to the regular work they do. Probably they might know a lot of details, but around that, if they do not ask, that shows that curiosity levels are not high, which may not be the right approach for things like us, because they have to learn something very new.
Right.
They have to connect things, a lot of things, you know, because everything is a system. In fact, at Skyroot we say like everybody should be a system engineer, you know.
Mm.
So that means even though probably your expertise is thermal or your expertise is structures,
right,
you need to know a little bit of everything. You need to know how your thing fits around everything else, right? So everybody is a system engineer. So you're building a system together, basically, right? So we see that system engineering skills, which is very, very important. Even though it's not your field, you should know at least what are the related things. You should know little fundamentals of all of that. And we come to know easily. We can easily filter the best guys by asking very fundamental questions. Mm-hmm. And these guys do a phenomenal job once they join.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they know all the fundamentals. They know, for example, if there is a stress engineer, like for example, doing structural analysis.
Right.
I ask him what is, something as fundamental as what is principal stress? Mm-hmm. Why are there these number of principal stress?
Right.
What is Von Mises? These are very fundamental things in that.
Yeah.
But I ask them slightly deeper questions. Why it is required? You know, why do we even need a failure theory?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is for which type of materials? Very fundamental questions.
Mm-hmm.
But many people, the way they answer itself, you know that there is no depth.
They just know it.
They just know it, but they don't understand it.
Yeah.
Right. So that's where these some very basic fundamental questions we start, and some people answer it very easily. Then we go next level. You go deeper, deeper, deeper.
Yeah.
But all will be with fundamentals. You know, and then you know that this is the candidate. You know, it comes in the gut. You
mm-hmm.
know that at the end of the day, I think the gut feeling plays a good amount of thing in recruiting a person.
Yeah.
Right. Of course, we do multiple people interview, but they know in the gut whether they're the right candidates to know.
Right.
So that also we give good importance to
mm-hmm.
subjectivity. Good amount of subjectivity is there. There is some good amount of objectivity is also there, like through giving problem statements, how they're solving. You know, it's a mix of subjectivity and objectivity, and we take the call.
Hmm. Would you say that Skyroot is mostly like research heavy right now, because you're still trying to develop and build a model, build systems right now? What percentage of Skyroot is research, and what percentage of it is project, like your next launch? What would you say?
Yeah, I think like now where everything is in development phase.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very engineering heavy, like fundamental engineering is a lot of system engineering and a lot of designs, new designs, and then, you know, a lot of developments, a lot of testing. Right. So almost everything is that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then project, maybe 20% into project. Management or program management directly, you know, looking at deep schedules and then linking things and supply chain and all that, you know. But mostly it is, most of the people are like working on a new system, developing a new system, building it, testing it, you know, qualifying it to the flight. I think that's, and all the systems are like we are building for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there's a lot of, in fact, for Vikram on itself, a lot of testing pending in the next 3-4 months, you know, and which is like very critical for our first launch. Right. So it's all learning every day, and a lot of new developments. It's not like in full-fledged project mode, I would say, but that would come, like you said, right, and maybe after a few launches.
Right.
Once it becomes like a vehicle becomes a workhorse. And
I believe that is why you look for fundamentals, because you're not just looking for people who can repeat what they did, but you want to build from scratch.
Yes.
So you will need the basics.
Yes.
All right. I just want to confirm, do you have some time left?
I think we can do. Yeah, we can push further. Yeah.
I just wanted to cover other models that you have. Maybe we can get into the liquid stages. This has like all solid stages apart from the sulfide one. What we call 860 or something Newton, that is used
in that is in the Vikram 1 for the roll control.
What do you use for just the stage of the satellite?
So whatever you've seen is the test which was done at IPRC is the uppermost stage,
the
one which will insert the satellites.
Okay.
And we have done one more test at VSSC before that, so that is for roll control. You know, it has an slanted nozzle.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so please explain Vikram 2.
Yeah, so Vikram 2 is almost, same as Vikram 1, except that it has a cryogenic upper stage. That means instead of a liquid stage, you have a cryogenic stage in the upper, as an upper stage, uppermost stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, fuels are different, earth storable fuels. For example, Vikram 1, the uppermost stage has, fuel and oxidizer, which are called MMH and N2O4. Mm-hmm. Right. So these are the propellants. And for here, we are using LNG and liquid oxygen, which are new propellants, I would say. But they're like the propellants of the future. And so we use LNG as a fuel and liquid oxygen as the, oxidizer. And both are like very at cryogenic temperatures, extremely low temperatures.
Right.
And then they burn and then create the thrust necessary thrust. And because the efficiency is higher, you get like more kickoff, more payload into orbit. And that's the only difference, you know. So mm-hmm. everything else is the same. So what we are using is that essentially 80% of the rocket, we're keeping it same. Mm-hmm. And then we're upgrading, we're adding things to it to boost payload so that we can cover a wide gamut of customer requirements. You know, some people may want larger payloads, you know, capability in the rocket. You know, some missions is only feasible with much higher payloads. So Vikram 2 and Vikram 3 fills that gaps, you mm-hmm. know. Even though Vikram 1 will be launched many times as possible, Vikram 2 and 3 will increase the you know, gamut of satellites you can launch. Mm-hmm. And that's where like this comes into picture. And then we have Vikram 3 as well, you know, which has boosters on the sides. So it is exactly same as Vikram 2.
Yeah.
And then you add these boosters, which will boost the payload by another, you know, 40%.
Are those solid boosters?
Yes. Yeah. First stage solid boosters. And then, you know, they, as you know, like they give, solid boosters give huge amount of thrust, you know, mm-hmm. as you have more thrust, you can, you know, put more payload mm-hmm. In the upper, you know, overall when you have good thrust in the upper stage, in the lower stage, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they do. And these are just upgrades of Vikram 1. 80% of all the series is the same.
Mm-hmm.
And Vikram S also, all the tech is the same. All the materials are the same. All the tech is the same. Yeah.
Right. Maybe I missed it. Did you say that this is going to go to high Earth orbits because of the cryogenic engine or low?
No, so all these vehicles are like low Earth orbit only.
Yeah.
But they have more payload capacity. Like that means if you take the same orbit, let's say 500 kilometers orbit, you know, one vehicle will have like, you know, 300 kilograms, you know, the other vehicles will have like 400, the mm-hmm. other will have 700. Mm-hmm. You know, for the same orbit, you can put in more payload.
Right. So why do you think, why would you say, of course, you know, but
yeah.
why would cryogenic engine give you a higher payload capacity? Can you please explain?
Yeah. So I mean, just the efficiency of cryogenic engines are higher,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, so there is this the term called ISP,
mm-hmm.
you know, specific impulse,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's more like how much thrust you can generate for unit propellant mass flow rate. If you give one unit propellant mass flow rate into mm-hmm. the engine, how much thrust you can generate. So that is the kind of a number which shows efficiency of the every rocket engine.
Mm-hmm.
So the more the ISP, the more you know, efficiency of the engine, the more payload the rocket can launch.
Mm-hmm.
Out of which, you know, the highest are the cryogenic engines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have the highest kind of ISP, you know, because they can generate more combustion temperatures and the molecules which eject out also have to be light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why hydrogen produces high this thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the lighter the you know, ejected molecules, the higher the temperature you generate, you get more efficiency. So the where cryogenic propellants give more of these, and you get more efficiency.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. Like the way that I thought of it in the basic manner is because it is liquefied.
Yeah.
So it is more energy per the amount you carry.
Yeah.
Can we say that?
No, I think solid, in that case scenario, solid has to be even more dense,
mm-hmm.
you know. So solid density is like way higher than liquid, you know, probably, mm-hmm. you know, than cryogenic, this thing is almost like more than double,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The energy density is higher with solid.
Right.
But the point is that efficiency matters, mm-hmm. overall efficiency matters.
Yeah.
So overall efficiency of cryogenic engine is way, way higher than the, you know, solid rockets.
Mm-hmm.
And that will give the boost in the payload, basically. Yeah.
Right, but you can fire cryogenic engine for longer time. Well.
Yeah, that's also an advantage. Where like, you know, you can even like all liquid engines you can burn for higher times,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can go for low thrust, you can burn for as long as you want, which is very good for upper stages. That's
mm-hmm.
where like, you know, Vikram 1 has a liquid upper stage which burns very long,
mm-hmm.
you know, like several hundreds of seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And even the cryogenic engine has several hundreds of seconds which we built, right? So that also has the capability to do very long duration upper stage missions, and
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one advantage which liquid engines have. Yeah.
Ah, okay, I'll just place it next to. Are their heights exactly the same? Because the only difference would be booster, right? Oh, no, it is taller. No,
it's the same. Yeah, 2 and 3, because the only difference is the booster, you know.
Yeah.
But the 2 will be longer, you know, because cryogenic density, propellant densities are lower than Earth storable liquids.
Okay.
Right. So because their densities are much lower, you have bigger tanks,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then so you need to have like you know, longer stages. So it's, and also mm-hmm. payload is also, capacity is more.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to, the topmost zone is where the payload fits in. So you have more payload. Slightly the, you know, the payload fairing is also bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So you overall have a much larger vehicle.
Right. So how closely is Skyroot working with ISRO? right now.
Yeah, so I think we get a tremendous amount of support for testing our engines,
mm-hmm.
and for at the launch pad, you know, for launching our vehicles.
Right.
So these are the two things which we get good support from ISRO.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have seen like the testings at IPRC.
Yeah.
And then there was at VSSC, then we have some testings coming up at Sriharikota, you know, at Satish Dhawan Space Center. And last year, the launch which we have done was at Sriharikota, you know, and the launch pad belongs to ISRO.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we utilize, you know, we fit our systems to, you know, launch using their, you know.
That was the same vehicles. Launch pad where they do Rohini launches at Shah,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, so they use that for RH-560, you mm-hmm. know, the larger vehicles mm-hmm. which they have in that domain. And that's what they use. And we use the same, you know, so we in fact tuned our vehicle to fit that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that we need not, you know, spend time effort in building a launch pad yeah. in the initial phase of development, where we need very focused effort on, you know, getting the launch vehicle right or the rocket right.
Mm-hmm.
So we get this launch vehicle, you know, launch pad support, you know, launch range support, you know, all the radars, communications that the rocket has, everything was through, you know, ISRO's, you know, equipment. And then even the mission control, you know, center was of ISRO's, right? So we utilize the facilities existing at ISRO and the launch pad existing at ISRO and the engine testing facilities at ISRO.
Mm-hmm.
And that is tremendous amount. I think if that angle is not there,
mm-hmm.
I think our whole development will take longer, it will yeah. take more money, it will take more infrastructure.
Right.
You know, from the lean thing where you have to focus on the rocket, you focus on all other things,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, it will take much longer. So I think this is a very, very good collaboration. I think without that, the government, you know, once it has opened up space, and, you know, ISRO has given tremendous amount of support. You know, they were like working as we are all together on a single mission,
right?
And even for our previous launch mission. And
yeah.
all our testing also, excellent support which they gave, right? And also they are like super experienced in whatever they do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you get a very seamless experience, you know, from the best experts.
Right. Yeah. And also ISRO needs private parts because it itself is creating some private entities on itself because it needs things to move faster.
Correct. Yeah.
And it also understands the value of a private entity that it is going to develop technology in a faster rate. All right. So just a trivia, just where there is a launch pad of these Rohini rockets in Sriharikota, there's an
yeah.
office where Dr. APJ Abdul Kalam used to sit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know about that, right?
Because yeah, yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
I saw that and I was told that this is where he used to spend all of his time while he was working on those.
Yes, right? Yes. So in fact, like the original Rohini series were launched from VSSC
mm-hmm.
at the... You know, at Trivandrum.
Right? Yeah, Tumba.
So as Tumba, at Tumba. And so once the rockets become bigger, you know, mm-hmm. the RH-560, etc., it became a bit dangerous to launch from Tumba, considering that, you know, it is a bit of a dense populated area there.
Mm-hmm.
So then at least the bigger ones are mostly launched from Sriharikota. It's mm-hmm. RH-560 series, single stage, two stage, you know, sounding rockets,
mm-hmm.
Which do a lot of measurements. In fact, there are some sounding rockets which go to 700 kilometers,
mm-hmm.
you know, altitude. So these big, high propellant rockets, you know, bigger size among these sounding rockets, they are launched at Shar,
mm-hmm.
and then there is also a very historic place where they sit and then do all the early scientists used to work. And
oh, the church you're talking about?
That is at Tumba. That is at Tumba. And that was the historic place, you know, where like a lot of early people used to launch there.
Mm-hmm.
And Sriharikota is like say much recent compared to what the sounding rocket launches happened
yeah.
in Tumba. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a question. I don't want to miss it. Yeah. So when it comes to solid boosters, and
yeah.
you have already done a launch,
yeah.
it is not possible for solid boosters to be assembled, let us say, in Hyderabad and do
yeah.
the launch in Sriharikota. It's very
yeah.
dangerous to transport it. So
yeah.
did you fabricate these stages in Sriharikota itself?
Yeah. So no. So what we have is like, you know, so there is one of our, you know, key partners who builds the propellants, you know.
Mm.
So, and so they are based in Nagpur. So they are a company called Solar Industries, right? So so once upon a time, there was nobody in the private sector,
mm-hmm.
You know, who builds solid propellants.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later after, you know, a lot of some privatization efforts,
mm-hmm.
and even the government wanted private to build this propellants, etc., etc. So over like probably over the last decade, they build that expertise. You know, there are like 2-3 companies who build solid propellants now. You know, so we are partnering with them, and they have all that licenses and, you know, that huge area where it is required to process them. You know, and then we utilize that expertise. In fact, not only them, we take you know, help from hundreds of companies you know, and of course these are some major companies like Solar Industries, but there are like so many smaller companies we take help from who build this expertise over the last 50-60 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I think they were handholded by ISRO and they brought to some you know, very good standard,
right.
And today we are able to utilize them and run very fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically literally we are standing on shoulders of you know, the 60 years of ecosystem built in India.
Mm.
Started by Dr. Sarabhai in 1960s.
Right. Yeah. Einstein once said the reason I was able to see so far was because I was standing on the shoulders of the giants.
Yeah.
I think it was Einstein, most likely, but that's what yeah. he said, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Of course. All right. This is not my question.
Yeah.
All right. But this question gets asked a lot of times to me.
Yeah.
I would imagine that people ask this question every now and then to you as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe not now, but during the time from 2018. Did you ever regret leaving your job at ISRO?
No, I mean, see, first of all, you know, as I mentioned, I loved my job there, mm-hmm. you know, so it was, you know, I would have probably, you know, continued and retired there as well,
mm-hmm.
you know, if Skyro did not happen.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, when I decided to quit, right, so, I mean, I didn't feel very sad, I would say,
mm-hmm.
because I knew this is an opportunity. I knew that mm-hmm. this is going to come and I knew that, you know, we're going to be one of the players who will be leading the way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a matter of time. So we took that leap of faith and started Skyroot. And now I think I'm enjoying even more. In fact, I work more with ISRO
yeah,
you know, very closely with you know,
right.
ISRO, because they give a lot of support for us. Right. So never regretted. In fact, I really feel you know, grateful that this happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's probably, you know, one thought did not come.
Mm-hmm.
One day, and you know, that probably the guts of leaving and starting something when there was nothing
mm.
Did not happen, that particular event did not happen, I would regret more, I would say.
Oh, okay.
It's good that, you know, it all happened and literally stars aligned for Skyroot to, you know, do what it is doing today. That was impossible. You know, we need phenomenal government support which came at the right time. You know, we need the right people.
Or maybe you made it happen, right? You paved the way for so many other organizations, private organizations.
See, we did our best, whatever we could.
Yeah.
You know, I think this has a lot of learnings. You know, in fact, I had a lot of thoughts thinking that, you know, should I build something else,
hmm.
some other company, and then, like, you know, make some money.
Mm-hmm.
And then start a rocket company.
Right, like Elon did.
Yeah.
Right. You build like yeah, two yeah. different companies.
So probably, you know, that was also there when I wanted to start, because I knew that I wanted to do this,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that India needs some private company badly, which is doing really well globally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, glad that there are a lot of new companies, you know, wanting to get into space. And, you know, that's very much needed for us. And then, but then something in the gut said, you know, let's start it
mm-hmm.
straight out. Even though a lot of things needs to align, just take the leap of faith, just start it. And, you know, it was a gut feeling that it is going to happen. And it perfectly happened. I think even if, let's say, there was little bit of delay in the policy coming, I think we would not have launched the way we launched
mm-hmm.
last year. It would
mm-hmm.
have gone much, much longer,
mm-hmm.
and we would not have raised the capital we needed. We would not have had the, you know, people we have today.
Mm-hmm.
I think everything came perfectly. It's as if, you know, it's as if all the stars aligned to make
mm-hmm.
it happen. And
mm-hmm.
and I think it's good. We are glad that we're here, but still, you know, we feel that we are in a very early phase.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we have completed 5 years, you know, probably very few companies
still young.
Have crossed.
Like, look at what ISRO was in 1969 or so.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, of course, you know, so that's yeah. a very probably a very historic journey which
mm-hmm.
all inspires all of us,
mm-hmm.
but you know, considering the private sector building systems from scratch,
mm-hmm.
you know, we are like one of the first few there, and then like coming 5 years, you know, very very early phase, still,
right.
you know, even though we have done a launch close to another launch, but still I think a very early phase, taking baby steps now. I think a lot of interesting years ahead,
mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of interesting decades ahead of us. You know, let's hope for our best, and you know, and probably maybe more stars will align in the future. We have to just keep doing the right thing.
Sure, but running a company like this, you make it seem like easy, right? The way that you talk, but I can't imagine some dark days that you have been through or some rock bottoms that you have faced. Were there any such like such
events?
Oh my
god!
Like
I mean,
that?
I think so many. I mean, there's no like count to it. So many.
What's the worst?
Dark phases. I think the worst phase I would say is like the huge. I think tension during the COVID time.
Oh yeah.
COVID time, you know. So so everything was at a stall for almost an year.
Yeah, right? You can't transport so things.
Can't transport anything. Nothing. Everything was stopped. Yeah, you know, all yeah. factories were stopped.
Right.
And we are highly dependent on, you know, people's vendors. You know, and they have their own challenges, financial challenges. You know, like things were not opened. Everything was completely locked down. Right. And these are all hardware which needs to come for manufacturing, testing. You need people to move around. You need, like, you know, you need trucks to move around. You need facilities to open. You need them to be financially stable. I think there's a lot of huge stress during that time. And then that is the time when we had to raise our next round, you know, funding. Right. We were just depleting our seed round of capital.
The most difficult time,
you know.
For
a space organization. And then we just raised 10 crores before that. You know, just 10 crores. And then we were running the company for 2 years, more than 2 years. You know, probably, you know, the end of COVID would have run out of money. And then we had to raise the capital, and it's taking much, much longer than we anticipated. You know, because raising like something like 100 crores is not easy when there's no policy.
Of course.
You know, when there is literally nothing, you know, where milestones were also very few at that time. Right. We were just building the hardware, where we had to test a lot of hardware. So I think there was a very critical time where we had to raise 100 crores just for some people, just betting that the company will do really well, policy is going to come, so all the stars aligned, literally.
Right.
And that was a very difficult decision even for investors at that time.
Now, you say stars aligned all the time, but I can't imagine you not being a person who made this happen, because you are the one pitching this idea and you're talking to investors who has no experience most likely in this domain, but you convinced them, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, so really, we were lucky to have investors who are entrepreneurs, you know, because they know the journey, you know. So
right.
You know, I think it's very difficult for, you know, probably funds to put in that money, you know. So, like, you know, we raised 10 crore by almost a single person, almost. And then we raised 100 crores, you know, mostly by, you know, one single set of people, right? So that conviction is very difficult to get for a fund. Because space is not a thesis for most of the funds at that point of time. And then, see, unless there is regulation policy, right, betting big money is literally impossible. You know, you're asking for too much favor by any fund to actually put in money when a lot of things are yet to happen, when the, you know, the environment is not good enough for you to succeed. Right. So I think that was a very tough phase where, like, we felt whether, you know, we'll take a very long time to raise capital and then what to do, you know. So the biggest worry is that we have to just stall a lot of activities for a long period of time, which will affect all the aspirations which we had. So that fear was, I think, one of the very lows in the journey, I would say. But a lot of learning.
Did you have a backup plan at that time?
No, backup plan is just continue doing what you're doing.
Okay.
But be lean, you know. So, yeah. So, because we knew that at least from the founders' part, right? So, whatever happens, we will continue. You know, at least, you know, we will be there pushing the boundaries. You know, even with a small team, you know, we'll do some progress. You know, because we are very well prepared for the long term, very well prepared for long run. And then, you know, we knew support would come. You know, but COVID made it difficult, considering that it's a natural scenario. Everybody priorities change. You know,
it's probably like 90% of the world's lowest point, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, nobody expected that to happen. And, you know, even funds were being, like, you know, they're being more cautious, investors are more cautious, people are more cautious. I mean, everything. I mean, it's a completely different time altogether. But we are glad that I think everything went well. We raised a large Series A amount, and then, you know, we raised, like, large capital later on for multiple launches. I think, like, literally stars aligned in that way. But there was lows. That was the extreme low, one of the extreme lows, I would say, but the extreme low of what, among them, you know, quite a few. And then I think there are, like, other laws as well, you know, and right, you know. So one is, like, you know, when some technology is not happening in the time we want to make it happen, it's very frustrating.
Most things don't work, right? Most things don't work.
Yeah.
All right. I'm just going to interrupt you for a second because I'm afraid that might run out and don't want an abrupt cut.
Yeah.
You don't have a lot of questions. I mean, I respect your time, obviously.
No problem. Yeah.
All right. So I just want to continue from there. What do you think is the most important quality a person who is running a private space organization should have?
Yeah, so I think persistence would be very, very most important, naturally, because you'll have several lows during the journey. And you know, several times you'll feel that things are not working out as you expected.
Mm.
So you'll feel that, okay, probably, you know, you're maybe in the completely wrong direction,
mm.
which you cannot even reverse it in the, you know, it'll take probably years to reverse anything, change the codes, right? You know, but you have to take good decisions at the right times, probably very bold decisions, even though they're very, very difficult decisions. You need to take those right bold calls, just rather than continuing with the flow. And I would say like persistence and agility mixed with agility. I think this is the key, I think, for every space founder should have. And I think that that's what I've observed in my journey as well. So anything imbalance in these two, I think it will be probably a much tougher journey than we would imagine. But mm-hmm. I think naturally it comes, you know, as you do the journey, it will probably, you know, the journey will force one, you know, founder to actually have a good balance of these. Yeah.
Since you were already very entrepreneurial, you have always been, did you study other entrepreneurs to understand that these are the qualities I need? Did you have these qualities when you were a scientist at ISRO as well? Or you started to develop these qualities when you left ISRO and started to see the struggle?
Yeah, so what I felt is that I always focused on the fundamentals, always, mm-hmm. you know, from whether it is school, college, everywhere, you know, whether during mm-hmm. my times at ISRO, because I didn't accept, even at ISRO, right, if something is given to me,
mm-hmm.
I didn't accept it as it is. I wanted to know why it is, you know, mm-hmm. what is the science behind it, what is engineering behind it, why it was not something else, you know.
Right.
So same way, that is the way I approached everything in life, right from the fundamentals. I need to know why these things are this way, and you know, why it is this way, not some other way, right? So that that kind of mindset is always there. And so when I decided to start a company, I stuck to the fundamentals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what actually is building a company, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how is you raise capital? What is equity? You know, how do you lose equity? You know, and how do
Did you know about these things beforehand?
No, not at all.
You just learned.
Crazy. I was a pure tech guy. You know?
Your friend Bharat, is he more managerial, or both of you guys?
No, I think both of us are both technocrat tech guys. You know, mm-hmm. fully. And then, you know, we had to learn these things in the journey itself.
Mm-hmm.
And while starting, you know, I have no clue even how people raise funds. Literally, I'm telling you, literally, I have no clue how people raise funds, how to go to investors.
Okay.
You know, literally, how that money comes. Does it come as a loan? Does it come as an, you know, how does it come? If it comes as a loan, what will be the interest? Absolutely no clue,
mm-hmm.
literally. You know, I only see in the news that, okay, so and so company raised so much capital, this thing, that thing. But I have literally no clue how that process happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew nothing about fundraising,
mm-hmm.
nothing about starting a company, running a company, registering a company, you know, what all kind of roles a company needs, you know.
Right, you probably did not know about paying the taxes, right?
Yeah, I know, I knew there'll be some tax. I didn't know, like, you know, what kind of tax will it be, and you know, all that. And literally, I didn't know much of anything,
mm-hmm.
but I went with the flow, you know, whenever, for example, when I had to raise funds for the, you know, venture, you know, I learned the fundamentals of, you know, what is, how to raise funds, how other people have raised funds, you know, what is the typical transaction like, you know, mm-hmm. what will be the process like, right? And but I don't think these fundamentals will take time to learn for anybody, not only me,
right.
For anybody, it will not take time. So I stuck with the fundamentals, whatever happened as and when go. But I was driven by basically the kind of drive to start a very, you know, world-class company out of India, space company out of India. That was the whole drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew this opportunity is there. And I knew that we can make a difference, you know, me and Bharat, you know, we can make a difference and then, you know, play our role in making it happen. So that was there as a gut feeling that it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else, we learned it on the go. You know, all the process, we learned it on the go as and when it comes,
mm-hmm.
You know, with just like, you know, shuffling with the fundamentals,
mm-hmm.
basically. Even now, for example, I don't know very deep finance stuff, even now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we raised like more than 500 crores. I don't know like deep finance stuff even today. You know, I keep learning as and when it is required, and now like more and more, you know, finance knowledge because of the journey. And mm-hmm. that is also very important, you know, so that also I'm learning, you know, deep. So I'll ensure that at least the minimum fundamentals are known, so that, you know, you make the right decisions and you not, and you do not end up with some, you know, grave mistakes. At least that knowledge base I'll try to have. And that's what I think a founder does What he does is that he knows little bit of everything and connects all of them. That's that's typically the journey of every founder. You know, he has to know about every role in the company. You know, he has to know about, you know, every you know, phase of the development. You know, a little bit of every tech involved in it. You know, so everything. You know, so probably the tech was slightly easier, even though it's rocket science. You know, because of
you had a foundation,
yeah, foundation with ISRO. So the tech was slightly easier to go, but compared to other things, but we've learned on the go, and
I'm not reading any tweet. I'm just seeing if there are more questions I might miss out. But you see, I barely looked at it even a single time, although you can see that there were so many questions, but most of them, I mean, almost all of them are already covered in the unscripted way of conversation that we had. And I just want to thank you for existing and doing what you do, because you are not only inspiring so many space enthusiasts, you're also creating opportunities for so many of them. And I can understand deeply, because all I wanted to do was to work in a space organization. That's it. I was never interested towards government job, even though I entered and exited two different central government jobs. I was all interested towards space organization, building a career in that. And seeing you doing that so for a billion population, showing them light, it's really very commendable. And before I go, I just want to give you something.
Oh.
I brought a copy of my book. I wrote something for you, so this is not the copy. It would have been horrible if
so I have a signed copy of Ashish Ranjan's The Boy Who Did Not Sign, right? Yeah, so it's, I'm sure, like, I think it's been it's not easy to write a book. And congrats on your journey, and, you know, and, you know, bringing together a book, and, you know, which will inspire a lot of people. I think, you know, probably, you know, invite all people to, you know, read your book as well. And thanks for the copy. Yeah, it was a surprise. And thanks a lot for the message as well. I think pretty nice message. You said, thank you for doing what you do, you're an inspiration to a generation of space enthusiasts. I think, I mean, really, you know, thanks a lot to hear these wonderful words, and good to have your book. Probably, you know, I'll get inspired from this as well.
No,
to some extent.
You might be able to relate with that, because the more I listened to you, the more I understood that this person is just madly in love with space science and engineering. And that's the story of the boy on which the whole story revolves around, and the plot. I do not know if you have enough time to read a book, but whenever you get some time, if you read a few pages, you will be able to relate to it. And that is why it was very important to bring you one copy, no matter what happens.
Great. I mean, thanks, Ashish. I think it's wonderful talking to you. And, you know, all the best for the great work, and also, you know, a new journey as an author. And, you know, all the best to you for the future as well.
Thank you. And thank you for being awesome and cool about everything. Like, you gave me the space. This is not my studio. I'm in Hyderabad right now, in Skyroot's office. They gave me this place. They managed everything. This is a Sunday.
You have had
a long day as well. I was in Hyderabad only for one day, and you manage your schedule accordingly. And I'm really grateful. It was a very interesting talk. I would like to do it again sometime. And I'd like to talk more about where the Skyroot is going.
And I think I'm really glad to see that, you know, you're based in LA, and, you know, brought all the equipment for this podcast right from there. I think really, you know, grateful for that. I think I think it's very small gesture from us to host you today.
Right.
And I think all the best to you as well. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. It was a lovely time talking to Pawan Kumar Chandana over here. Chandana, sorry. I every now and then mess up the last. And thank you for listening to us for, I don't know, over an hour, definitely. And we are going to run it again. And we keep on doing art podcast every week. Tune in. And that's about it. See you next time. Till then, bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Wow. It was great. How was the experience?
Good.